I am Daniela Milan from the Cleveland Council on World Affairs, and this is our Global Conversations podcast. Every year, the Cleveland Council on World Affairs looks forward to being a community partner with the Cleveland International Film Festival. We selected One Life this year as our partner film, as we are continually mindful of the growing refugee crisis worldwide. In fact, we annually host a How to Plan a Refugee Camp event, where attendees learn about the policies that protect refugees and internally displaced persons, as well as how to ethically build the camps that house them. Today, CCWA has gathered this group of individuals to discuss the complex realities surrounding the refugee crisis. Joining us, we have Akshay Shah, the producer of the One Life documentary, Patrick Kearns, the executive director of Refugee Response, and Paul Frankman, a former humanitarian law trainer at the American Red Cross. Our council's hope is that through this dialogue, we will shed light on the worldwide refugee crisis and inspire others to think about our responsibility as global citizens in these humanitarian crises. The One Life documentary tells the story of the Rohingya refugees, who the United Nations has identified as one of the world's most persecuted minorities, and their life inside the world's largest refugee camp. Akshay, could you share with us how you decided to produce this film and what in particular about the Rohingya situation in Myanmar inspired you to tell this story?
Sure, thank you. So with this film, we were actually lucky in that this story was brought to us. I say us, I'm speaking on behalf of my co-producer, Robert DeVorn, and the film's director and cinematographer, Josh Turnbow. Back in 2017, in December of 2017, a colleague of ours asked if we were aware of the Rohingya refugee crisis that was happening in Myanmar and Bangladesh. And to be honest, like many Americans, I really didn't know much about it. He was planning to go visit the camps, and his friend, who happened to be an executive at the UN's World Food Program, they invited us to join them, which led to a unique opportunity for us to produce a documentary that would help shed light on this crisis. I started researching as much as I could on the subject, and a week later, I was visiting a refugee camp for the first time in my life, and it was and still is the most heartbreaking thing I've ever gone through. At the time, the Rohingya had only been there for a few months after being violently kicked out of their homes, so there was still visible trauma and terror in their faces, especially the women and children, many of whom still had fresh scars and bruises, and all of them had stories of this genocide that had taken place. And I saw it all firsthand through the eyes of the victims. What made it a little easier to swallow were the hundreds of thousands of kids in the camp still laughing and playing. And in that imagery, there's an immediate juxtaposition between the innocence of the young generation compared to the suffering and pain in the eyes of their parents and grandparents. We came home and agreed this was something that everyone needs to know about, and the mainstream media had barely touched on the atrocities that had taken place in Myanmar. And key to any documentary is having access to the story, which we had through the WFP. So we started developing the idea in a way that it would not only educate Americans, but also build an emotional connection with the Rohingya as well.
You talk specifically about kind of the suffering that you saw with each human there and the specific challenges that come with the Myanmar population in that crisis. Paul, can you look at things kind of on a larger scale, that bigger picture, to show us how great the global refugee crisis really is?
So I went to the UNHCR site, which keeps the numbers up in terms of the state of the crisis globally. They're the United Nations organization that's responsible for monitoring and managing and coordinating a lot of the humanitarian relief to refugees. According to their site, there are 70.8 million forcibly displaced people around the globe, 41.3 million of whom are internal to their countries. 25.9 are defined as refugees, which is specific status. Those are people that fear persecution or harm if they go back and cannot protect themselves. Countries that receive them are bound to protect them and not send them back. 3.5 million are asylum seekers, and that doesn't count stateless people, people within countries like the Rohingya, within Myanmar, that don't have the protections and basic human rights to education and work and healthcare and everything else because of their second-class status. 80% of the refugees are in countries neighboring the country that they have been driven out of. It's a challenge when they get to camps as to what to do with them. It tends to become more of a permanent situation. But the fourth is that nothing happens. If there's a political solution, they could perhaps be returned. If countries would allow, they could be resettled into a third country, such as the United States, which is beyond the boundaries of most of the countries that are hosting refugees. or in many cases, like seems to be happening somewhat in Bangladesh from the film, is that the Rohingya and other groups might integrate into the host population and become seen as an asset, something to work with, kind of a development way of looking at it. The United Nations High Commissioner on Refugee also listed a number of different countries that considered crises. This whole coronavirus is another crisis. Now it's global. And another thing that the agencies have to help refugee camps that are very concentrated deal with, but they identified Venezuela, Central African Republic, Burundi, Iraq, the Rohingya crisis, Yemen, Central America, which are the refugees fleeing drug violence and gang violence that have reached our borders, Syria, Democratic Republic of Congo, Europe, in terms of the refugees that are coming from all over to seek asylum there, Nigeria, and South Sudan. So as far as specific places, that's kind of the big picture for refugees.
This crisis truly is global, and it comes from so many different political hotspots and areas where there's constant conflict and these people are driven out of their homes and into camps that are clearly struggling to give them the human rights that they all deserve. Aksha, in the film, you do a really incredible job of focusing on a handful of individuals, and Noor in particular comes to mind. But you also tell the story of the organizations and the workers that are trying to provide relief to these refugees. What did you learn from covering both sides of that reality?
We were actually introduced to the humanitarian world through the point of view of the aid workers. And it was clear that they would be major characters in the story from the get-go. But basically, with the assistance of the folks at the World Food Program, our small documentary team was able to bypass a bunch of hurdles throughout the production of this project. Before they even knew what the film would be about or that they would, in fact, be part of it, they offered us logistical support as well as knowledge and guidance into the subject matter because we were completely new to all of this. But we quickly discovered you can't tell a refugee story at scale without telling the story of the people who are responding. These are highly skilled individuals who have dedicated their lives to helping people in need. Being in a refugee camp for a few days or weeks is shocking to most people. Humanitarians are there for months or years without breaks often. What they go through mentally and physically is staggering, and then you realize the massive scale at which they do it. It was important to us to show this because these efforts are largely unknown and therefore unappreciated by a majority of the world.
Certainly, and Patrick, you've worked as an international aid worker in refugee camps. Can you speak a bit about that experience and what it was like for you?
Yeah, sure. 2002, I ended up actually moving into a refugee camp that was on the other side of the country. So I was on the northern Thai border with Myanmar. And I actually lived in the camp for 2 years with a group of people called the Karen that are on that border. And I guess I would compare it to this case and say, like, you know, flash forward 20, 25 years. And that's the situation where I was in at that time. So this had been a long-term conflict, displacement that happened starting really around the 80s that pushed out a huge amount of people across the Thailand border. But a lot of the situations are the same still to this day. The camp that I was living in, you know, like Akshay said, for the first 2 years, we had a very informal agreement to be in the camp. I won't get into too many specifics on how that actually worked, but it was a camp that was controlled by the Thai military. It was surrounded in barbed wire and concertina wire. And it was controlled by the Thai military. So the refugees in the camp, they were really, as we call in the industry, warehoused in that camp. So not a lot of access, not a lot of opportunity. And, you know, I think what Paul said was right on with the strategies. They're called the durable strategies. And in that context that had been going on for so long, while the conflict was still happening, was still hot, on one hand, the durable strategies were almost inconsequential to the refugees because Thailand did not want them to come into the country. Thailand hadn't signed the Geneva Convention. So it allowed just the aid agencies to provide support while they were warehoused in this context. The refugees themselves had no interest in returning across the border back into Myanmar. And I think a lot of similarities we see in these cases are when a group pushes people out, like when the military and when the government pushes people out, they immediately confiscate the land. And all of a sudden, the documents, the histories are lost, that land titling, it becomes the property of the government that's displaced them or affiliations or branches of the government. And so then you talk to people about strategies for return, and the question remains, return to what? What is there to return to? So with what we see now and what we've been seeing for the past couple of years is a dramatic downturn in the amount of people being resettled. It really does call to mind Paul's fourth point, which is just waiting, right? And what does this future look like? And that's, you know, I think a lot of what we see globally is this, just this continued uncertainty of what this future looks like. And while that's happening, there's not time to prepare people for, you know, the different possible solutions that might come. A few of the Rohingya that have been resettled to places like Canada, but, you know, I can just imagine that transition and what they were prepared for. It's got to be really, really challenging of seeing that through. And, you know, it's the same thing that we've seen from this side as well, is that often how can you prepare somebody to integrate into a life in a country like Canada or in a city like Cleveland, when in the case where I was, they've been in a refugee camp for 25 years or where they grew up there and had their family there. And often the preparation is a period of hours or days as opposed to weeks or months.
So there is that kind of cultural shock that would automatically come from this resettlement. There's also that question of, there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of these individuals that are still stuck in these camps in a way and not able to have any kind of legal path forward or a way for them to resettle with or without their family in a new population and in a different space. Akshay, the film does make a point about the entire international relief system. What did you learn about that system in making this film?
For me, at the beginning of this, I had barely heard of the World Food Program. I guess the first thing I learned was the role of each different UN agency and major non-governmental organizations, how they all interact together to tackle the world's biggest problems. I quickly realized international aid is the largest and possibly the most complex system in the world. There's so much more that goes into providing for people in need than I could ever imagine. The World Food Program is feeding 80 million people in 80 different countries, but what they don't divulge are the bureaucratic and diplomatic hurdles that Patrick was talking about. They face this every step of the way. From this crisis's perspective, when the refugees arrived at Bangladesh, a remote piece of land almost immediately became the fourth largest city in an already densely populated country. International aid organizations are the ones who built it into a mega camp extremely fast. They efficiently built systems for housing, provided food assistance, sanitation, healthcare, all in real time, and all while negotiating with the local government every step of the way. I think what's interesting is they all take on a multitude of responsibilities that go beyond what their name or what their slogan calls for. The World Food Program obviously provided food, but surprisingly, they also provided logistical support by building roads and infrastructure and establishing cell towers. And they even leveled out unstable ground for new housing or to prepare for the monsoon season. I think what I learned the most, though, is the difficulty these humanitarian organizations have in finding a balance between providing aid and not taking sides or speaking out on human rights or international law violations. For instance, Doctors Without Borders, possibly the most important agency because they always manage to get into the most difficult places where needs are the highest. They were providing medical aid in Syria, but they decided to speak out against the Assad regime and its use of chemical weapons, and they were kicked out. Until luckily they were recently allowed to go back. But those are the types of dilemmas they find themselves in with every single crisis.
On top of those dilemmas, there's obviously that instance of a local government not wanting those international organizations present, those instances where it's very difficult for an organization to not take a side, especially when there's active conflict on the ground. Paul, what does humanitarian law kind of tell us about the international assistance to refugees that organizations like the World Food Program or Doctors Without Borders can provide?
Okay, so I kind of want to second what Akshay was saying about what I've learned through helping with Red Cross as a volunteer is just how many people are connected, all of these aid agencies working together in partnership in different camps according to agreements. And it's amazing the dance that they're able to do with each other and the sharing that they do. And how it's a good career for young people. I'm a teacher. How much genius this whole system requires. And what a great challenge for young people to consider doing if they want to make a difference is that one thing leads to another. And it all is done in the best intention of a humanitarian perspective. As far as refugees go, just background goes to the 1951 Refugee Convention, which was promoted by the United Nations and signed by most countries in the 1967 protocols that define what a refugee is. And the biggest power in that is for protecting refugees is that they cannot be sent back. It's a principle of non-refoulement. They can't be sent back to a country where harm might come to them. And therefore, no country that has refugees coming into it legally can really turn them away. Once they're there, they are to be protected in terms of basic human rights, to work, housing, education, public relief, access to the courts, to have identity and travel documents if necessary, to move on if that's possible. So a lot of the registration that takes place is a protection that has become kind of part of the system that they do. You know, it is, as Patrick said, it's kind of universal what you're seeing with refugees. These are human beings, but in each particular situation, it's different socially, politically, and economically in terms of where they're coming from and what they're getting into. And so it does need to be somewhat specific to the country where refugees and displaced people are going. They have a right to live in security and dignity, and that ultimately is the responsibility of the host country. So the biggest thing is they can't be sent back. So what do you do with them? And that's a challenge for, in many cases, countries that are in economic trouble and have a hard time doing it. Bangladesh, as pointed out in the film, is one of the most populated countries in the world, one of the most densely populated countries, has taken in 1 million more people and has done that graciously. And there's been some incredible stuff that's been going on there with the facility of the humanitarian organizations kind of making things fit without, you know, again, taking sides. So that's something else that comes out of the conventions. As far as Red Cross goes, in time of armed conflict, then the Geneva Conventions apply. And that's really the biggest international humanitarian law from the point of view of the Red Cross, or the Geneva Conventions, the fourth one, and Additional Protocol 1. They all designate refugees as being protected persons, and there are special rules that apply in times of armed conflict to the combatant nations. And they're very similar to what is upheld by the Refugee Convention. And when we did teach this program, it was something that came out in 2002, actually, when Patrick was in the camp. The ICRC felt that people needed to be aware of the rights, whether it was refugees or anybody, so that people could do better by each other all around, try to prevent some of the things that were then going on in the world, to uphold the Geneva Conventions and hopefully, you know, anticipate and prevent future situations that would create unnecessary refugees. It's basic principles that apply to work in times of even natural disasters. So you look at the Haiti earthquake, look at what happened in Hurricane Katrina with people moving within our own country from New Orleans into Houston. And there's a lot of basic things that kind of come out of the principles. But going back to what Akshay was saying about these agencies, the Red Cross and others have these seven fundamental principles, first two of which are impartiality and neutrality. And so they've got to walk that line. They can't take political sides. It's not their job to create the political solution. That's the countries have to work that out. That's what the United Nations is for. That's whatever could be brokered among the country that is driving the people out and the country next to it that is hosting them. They are bound, these organizations, to be neutral and impartial, take care of the people, and let that be that. That's kind of the sense of things in a nutshell, in terms of obligations, responsibilities, and how this most complex organization in the world actually operates.
As a Lebanese citizen myself, I'm very aware of the situation in the Middle East and more so of the Syrian conflict and the fact that there are so many Syrian refugees created from that conflict, many of which are now in camps across Lebanon. You talked about these international norms with basic rights. Are there consequences in failure to provide these basic rights? Because it's very clear that there are instances across many conflicts in which refugees are not given those basic rights.
Okay, so that's something, again, that gets into the political. So these laws that protect, they apply to the nations. And countries essentially need to go after each other. So there are the international criminal courts. I know the generals in Myanmar, and this was in the film too, have essentially been accused of war crimes. And countries can put pressure to try to bring about change. And the United States was looked to because of our economic strength. I think China, eventually in the region, would become a player too. But to what extent do you engage with a country, or to what extent do you punish a country economically to try to cause changes to happen so a political solution can result? But ultimately, a lot of this international humanitarian law falls upon the countries to enforce themselves. And in countries that have failed, then sometimes courts are created that might deal with it. And those tend to be on a case-by-case basis. So it's happened in Rwanda. It's happened in different countries in Africa. You've got the International Tribune in The Hague. It's limited, but I think the principle is basically trying to enable humanitarian organizations to do their work, to take care of people, and to build awareness. World public opinion, I think, is a very big, powerful thing that can help bring about solutions to the different issues. But ultimately, accountability, it comes down to the host nations, the home nations, and international community of nations, because that all has to do with the political.
So many of these places that have been brought up, Rwanda, Syria, Myanmar, they're all across the world from the United States. Patrick, looking to you, for our listeners here, why does the global refugee crisis matter in Ohio? Why should we care as Ohioans?
I think it's an important question, and a lot of people right now are going to say it doesn't. A lot of people are going to say, especially in light of the current situation we're in, why do we bother with these issues that we don't understand with populations on the other side of the earth that sometimes we've never even heard of before? I obviously disagree with that. I think it's very short-sighted. I think it's short-sighted in two sides. I think it's short-sighted morally. I think there is a moral obligation that we have for the spot that America has played in the world. And you can get into a conversation when we talk about Syria, like how much have we been involved in the actual instigation of some of these unstable issues going back decades. I mean, I think there is a certain level of accountability that we have in order to respond in a humanitarian way. You know, I think the IRC, their president, David Miliband, make a very compelling argument for the moral response. I also think, as Paul was really talking about, is that there is a international political response to this as well. You know, at this time, there's this refrain going around through different countries and different leaders that we need to allow countries to deal with their own issues, right? We need to not interfere in the business of other countries. I think in one sense, it's laughable because you can see how quickly bad actors, their issues spill quickly across the borders, and not just their neighboring borders, but regional and even, you know, continental borders. In one hand, this lack of response, this not engaging, incentivizes bad actors to continue without paying any cost for it. Part of the response, and I think Paul really said this very well, is tied into the sanctions and the punitive actions that are put in place in order to respond to some of these issues. Not only then stabilizing a population of, at times, hundreds of thousands or up to a million people that are now displaced. And so what does the next 20 years look like if we continue to see a lack of response, continued displacement? Because one thing I can guarantee, people like, you know, the Rohingya in Myanmar, they didn't decide to leave because there was international aid support. They didn't decide to leave because, oh, you know, we have a feeling, you know, in a year down the road, the UN or the World Food Program can step in. They left because they were in fear for their lives. And that is not going to change. What is going to change is how we either decide to engage or not engage with that. And the continued lack of engagement is going to have an effect one way or another on everybody in the world. And it's either something that we can try to mitigate and get ahead of and be a part of the leadership of that, or it's something that we're going to reap the consequences of globally when we see how quickly these things can become uncontained.
I think we are kind of already seeing some of those facts that this is such a global crisis. This is in so many ways impacting dozens of nations. And there has been a failure internationally for many governments to respond in a timely manner. So with the film itself, here we are in Cleveland talking about this, talking about the documentary. And I'm sure that it's had kind of an impact around the country of people watching this. Akshay, what did you hope to achieve with the film? What did you want your audience to really take away?
First is increasing the awareness, like we're talking about right here. I think conversations like this are awesome and exactly what we want to continue when people see this film. And you mentioned it earlier in the film, we followed a little girl named Nur Kalima. We wanted to convey the feeling that we had when we went there, and Josh filmed it greatly in a way that it does develop that emotional connection between the Rohingya and our viewers. So on a human level, our hope is that we all can get together to help Nur Kalima and this young generation of Rohingya to have a future that's bigger than life in a refugee camp. We touch on this in the film, but we want people to imagine, what if that was your little girl? What if those are our families in that camp? If we as a society can collectively help them now, they will be able to help themselves for generations to come. Otherwise, the Rohingya, like many other refugees around the world, are stuck in this never-ending cycle of international aid. Nur Kalima's dream is to be a doctor, and that dream will fade, and her children's smaller dreams will eventually fade, and it'll just keep going on and on. My hope is that after watching this film, the audience feels that connection and more conversations like this happen and leads to that increased awareness of what is happening on the other side of the world. And eventually, people might feel inspired to do more and become engaged, like Patrick's talking about.
After watching the documentary, one of the many things that kind of stuck with me was that quote there at the end that just said, one child can make you realize why you're there. One child alone can kind of give you that call to action. As we start to wrap up this discussion, I'd like to point out for our audience that one of the many things that One Life depicted throughout the film was the ability of the refugee population to build a community despite their poor living conditions and the fact that they were no longer in a place that they could call home. Although many of the families were separated or the individuals came into the camps alone, there was a constant effort to create hope and a sense of both stability and unity. The instinct of humans to create community is seemingly universal, and the hope that the refugees in One Life had allows the audience to realize just how human and interconnected we all are. So the last question that I pose for everyone here, as global citizens, why should this continue to matter? What should we do moving forward?
Hard to be neutral and impartial about that. So I'd like to hear maybe from Patrick before he's done, when he has a turn. I'm a teacher, so I teach eighth graders. We don't have any refugee in my community, but I think that this is a great story to get out to our students. In eighth grade, we study a lot of things in American history that relate very much, and as he pointed out, focus on humanity, focus on the dignity, focus on the courage of people to overcome incredible things. We have just learned about Jackson and the Indian removal. This relates. We are now getting into the Civil War, and you look at the contraband, the slaves that ran away as the Union Army moved south and moved north, and what they were able to do, and the community that they created. There's so many stories in American history that this is a reflection on. It's basic humanity. And so there's that old kind of slogan about think globally and act locally. We can do things. UNHCR has pointed out some things that we can do, mainly awareness and donating to help the people over there. But by understanding them and appreciating their humanity, it might make us better over here. I mean, I'd like to think that the COVID-19 crisis is more global. And here's an opportunity now to be able to think beyond ourselves. That's there. The American ideals. At the end of the film, why should America care? Noor's asking, you know, or the mom, do you want to go back to Myanmar? And she's like, no, I'll never go back there. And mom says, well, maybe we'd go to America. She didn't say any particular place else. And we've studied the Declaration of Independence, and it's about life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, about all men are being created equal, and the idea that every individual has worth. And I think that's the power of the story of this film, is focusing on the individuals. Kids will care about that, but I think by relating a lot of what they might see in this to their own lives, they might become better people towards each other right now, and then in the long run, they might aspire to be doctors without borders like Noor and make the world a better place. So I think that's kind of the power of the film and the importance of looking at everything happening around the world and, you know, seeing ourselves as a part of that. Like as I said, as a teacher, eighth graders, Patrick, and actually, how can I get this to them down the road? But then locally, what can students and schools and teachers do for the refugees that have come to our area that would make it easier for them to, like you said, integrate to a very different culture?
Oh, a lot of things come to my mind. I guess the first one is that story of resiliency that I think is important. And I'd say all that is something when we talk to students, when we talk to young people, and when we work with teenagers, is important to understand. And, you know, we work with a lot of refugee teenagers in Cleveland. And getting them to understand that their own story is a story of resiliency and strength, I think, is important. And I always like to flip the script as much as possible when there's this perspective to look at refugees as, you know, being the victims and at times being helpless of situations. And I think when we flip the script, and the way that especially teenagers can, you know, be empowered by that is to understand what they've come through. And what they've come through is so profoundly different than their peers and the experiences that they've had. But I think that is something incredibly powerful for their peers and for us on the receiving end, on the resettlement city end, to be able to understand is that the resources that these people bring are really unparalleled to other populations that we have, even other immigrant populations that we have. And in light of the current situation, the COVID situation we're in now, one thing I take away from this is also the COVID situation gives lie to the belief that we are untouched by the events of the world, that we are unaffected, that we can live in this sense of naivete and innocence and be protected by it. COVID is one story, but I think the refugee situations across the world are a whole different story. I think it is very dangerous for us as a nation and as a people to have this mentality like, this is something that happens to other people over there. This could never happen to us. This could never affect my life. I think it's a very, very dangerous notion as a nation to take forward. So I think the more that we can understand these stories, the more we can understand the causes of these situations and how individuals have been able to respond and how we've been able to work towards solutions on these issues is much to our benefit. And then the last thing I think is important to understand is that, like so many of us, you know, when we use the term refugee, it's not a monolithic label that can go across the globe, right? Each of these situations, each of these camps, each of these nations, each of these causes is different. And I think it's important to understand that context if we're going to take some meaning from this.
Two of you have touched on this, but I certainly agree that this truly is a global moment with the pandemic that we're all facing. Patrick, you talked there about the resilience and strength that these populations have. And then if I can have Akshay just maybe share, what kind of resilience did you see from the Rohingya population as you were there in the camps, and any last thoughts that you have for us today?
Sure. Yeah. And by the way, those two answers were perfect and amazing. And I wish I had met you guys when we were making this film, because that would have helped a lot. I think it was a big challenge to connect this global crisis going on over there to people here. And now in this post-COVID world, I think UN agencies, NGOs, other humanitarian groups are going to be more important than ever. And I'm glad we're all connected to it now. As far as the resilience of refugees, it's crazy. We were there months after they'd gotten there. And those kids, like I said earlier, they were still laughing and playing. And that just shows you they can just bounce back. And I think they're looking at COVID-19 maybe coming to the camps. They're getting prepared for it, but they're like, okay, bring it on. You know, at this point, we got this. They've been through so much worse, I think. So, you know, they're building lives. They're living in the camps better than they were at home, but they're getting through it. They're still looking forward to the future. And as far as Americans, I think we need to remind ourselves that we have the responsibility of being a leader in the international community. It has been like that for 100 years now. And it's kind of crazy that we, through our tax dollars, are the biggest donors of international aid, yet a majority of us, and I was guilty of this too, are kind of clueless to what's happening outside of the U.S. at times. And historically, I think it's in this nation's blood to stand up for the little guy and stand up against oppression. I think we need to ask ourselves, how can we just ignore these atrocities going on in Myanmar or other places like that in the world? Hopefully we can band together to hold these people accountable and hold these regimes accountable for their actions.
It certainly is in the fabric of this country to have that mentality that we will offer a helping hand to our neighbors, to everyone around the world. This definitely is a nice, hopeful note to end on. It's been really incredible to have you all here and to share this discussion. To the audience, we hope that you take away at least a few lessons from this talk and perhaps some greater questions about the role of the United States in assisting displaced persons and refugees, and how governments, international institutions, and NGOs can work to ensure human rights for all people. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.